Here's a four-word question. Military and our economy.
We have long accumulated vested interests in the United States economy. All economies have that. We have, for example, the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us about so many years ago. We have long built up interdependencies between those states, for example, where military production is concentrated, California, the American South, and so on. We have likewise interdependencies of all kinds with what we might call the medical pharmaceutical complex, which in its way is just as important as the military complex. Government is involved with private enterprise and so forth. Absolutely, we have to take into account, as any reasonable, rational person would have to, that if we want to move away from dependence on these vested interests, that has to be done carefully, cautiously. The jobs of people that depend on them through no fault of their own have to be protected. To say the same thing in plain English, if you want to get out of a dependency you don't think is healthy, you need a lot of help and a lot of professional planning to get that job done. It's just like having a person who becomes dependent in an unhealthy way on a substance they need to disconnect from, on another person, on another community, or whatever. And the irony is, the only way to get out of a dependence on the military, or the only way to get out of dependence on a pharmaceutical industry that basically extorts higher prices from Americans to pay for medicine than any other people in any other country on earth have to pay, and that is the case, would be through what used to be called socialist planning. You have to get together and say, okay, we're now going to use these factories for something else. We're going to redesign the equipment. We're going to retrain the labor force. We're going to pay people so they don't suffer during this transition. It's worth it to us, because to have millions of people dependent, for example, on an industry that greens America is a much better kind of dependency than having them focus on making profits for pharmaceutical companies or weapons of mass destruction, which we have now. So if we want that, it is a technical problem and a political problem that we can solve, but there has to be the political muscle, the movement, the support to get it done, and we can't let the demand of the companies involved for their private profit to stand in the way. You know, the irony is, if you talk to leaders of those companies that are involved in military production or the pharmaceutical health complex, they'll tell you in private the following. If the government, because they know like we do that no one else is in a position to do this, if the government could guarantee to us, ironclad, that after the transition from what we have now to the future, we would be in the same economic position of profit, and then we would be in favor. We don't care. We're not in business to produce this thing or that thing. We're in business to make money. And if you can guarantee we can make money under a different regime, we'll do it. I've had conversations with people, for example, in the military, who say, if you can guarantee to me that making vehicles that are collective transport, you know, buses and vans, will be as profitable for this company as is currently making luxury automobiles for a tiny people, we'll do it. We don't care what we produce. We care how profitable. We get rid of things that are unprofitable and move to others, not because it's moral or noble, but because it's more profit. You create for us profitability. And let me tell you something. Let me use the automobile example. The only reason the car companies make cars is because it's profitable. And the only reason, and I'm really only exaggerating very slightly here, the only reason it's profitable to make cars is that the car company does not have to produce the road upon which the car moves. If the car company had to sell you a car that included not only the cost of making the car, but making and maintaining the road on which the car runs, the cost of the car would put it out of reach for everybody, and we'd have a public transportation system because none other is produced. Suppose the government said, we're ending the subsidy for cars, but we're going to give you a big subsidy for producing vans that will carry 20 people at a time. Guess what? We'd have this thing that everybody claims we can't have, and we'd have it overnight. But there has to be the political will. But that's what Occupy's job is, to build that will.
So you've just touched upon something I want you to go deeper on. What's in it for the 1%? You've talked about the dreams, the aspirations, the possible new structures that the 99% could promote. What's in it for the 1%?
The job of Occupy is to split the 1%, to appeal to those within that who understand in the long run that this is what's best for the people of this world, of whom they are a part. You know, the 1% too, in the end, depend on the other 99. You can't make money if you do not have people to buy what you sell. You keep squeezing the mass of your own workers under the deluded idea that the less I pay them, the more is left for me. You will come up against the following limit, that if you pay your workers less and less, they have less and less to spend on what you're trying to sell them.
So, Rick, you've talked a lot about the aspirations, the possible solutions that would help solve things for the 99%. What's in it for the 1%? What about them?
I think the issue is to understand that it is both possible and necessary to split the 1%. And let me do it this way. In the 1930s, when the CIO, the socialists, and the communists put all that pressure on Roosevelt that I spoke about earlier, Roosevelt used that pressure to go to the rich and to the corporations from whom he came, given who he was and his family. And he said to them, you better give me the money to provide the jobs for the unemployed, to create the Social Security system, which he did, to create the unemployment insurance system of America, which he did. You better give me the money to do it, because if you don't, it won't be me that you're dealing with. It will be those union people and those socialists and communists, and they're going to make a lot worse deal for you than I will. He split them. That's the only way the New Deal got passed. He split the business community. Half of them went with him and bought his argument. The other half were implacable enemies of his and went to work to undo the New Deal. And those are the Republicans then, and those are the Republicans today, who undo everything as fast as they can because they're serving the angry part of the business community that were never won over. But the point is, Roosevelt split them. We can split them again. We have to split them and say, look, come across and make a deal with us as far as you can, because it's in the interest of equity, it's in the interest of democracy, it's in the interest of the long-term viability of the United States, it's in the interest of avoiding civil conflict on a scale that is scary to contemplate, and for all those reasons, here's a deal we can work out and live with. I don't know how successful that'll be. It worked for Roosevelt, which is enough of a reason for it to be tried again. But it may not work, and then we'll have to struggle the 99 against a 1%. But even that is a kind of an open question. No one thought in the years before the collapse of the Soviet Union that it would collapse. No one thought that Mr. Mubarak in Egypt would be hounded out of office. No one thought, I'll finish the point. No one thinks it could happen in the United States. It's the same mistake. You build up the contradictions of a system long enough, and they blow up in your face. For 50 years, for the last half century in the United States, we have debated as a nation our transportation system, our education system, our health system. All the basic institutions of this society have been criticized and debated and changed, as should happen in a healthy society. One institution could not be criticized, could not be subject to national debate, could not be changed. That's called capitalism. It's our economic system, and it was taboo in this country. And you know, if you have an institution central to your society that cannot be criticized, cannot be debated, where all politicians struggle with one another to be the bigger cheerleader for the system, what you have is a system that behind that wall of protection rots, breaks down, becomes dysfunctional because it's never had its warts and its blemishes identified. There's been no change. All that Occupy is doing is correcting a sad 50-year history by forcing us finally to put our economic system where it should have been, upfront, personal, as an object to be criticized and debated. And if, as some of us believe, and I'm one of them, that this is a system whose historical justification is now over, then it's time to move on. The United States can do better than capitalism.
And you were just talking about politicians and cheerleaders. My one last question is, talk a little bit about elections. In broad strokes, we don't know when this is going to air, but elections and the discourse about the economy during the elections, whether that's focused on taxes or what have you. But you just mentioned how the politicians are key cornerstones of propping up capitalism, at least mentally as well as materially.
Politics in the United States long ago stopped being about a serious conversation about the basic system, because this basic system, capitalism, is a taboo subject. All we have is cheerleading. If you go to the website of President Obama before he won the election last time, on the economics page, the first homepage quotation from President Obama, then candidate Obama, had to do with the wonders of the private enterprise system in bringing us peace and prosperity, et cetera, et cetera. Right? As long as that's the governing ethos for both parties, what we have are Tweedledum and Tweedledee, two different parties that are two different ways of celebrating capitalism. Look, for example, occasionally Obama, who has been unable to tax the rich at all so far in his first term, makes noises about not extending the Bush tax cuts to the top few percent, those earning over $250,000 a year. What people don't understand is if he wins his way, Mr. Obama, he will raise the level of taxes for the richest American from the current rate of 35% to the pre-Bush tax cut rate, ready, of 39%. That's not a significant contribution of the rich, especially when you remember that in the 1950s and 60s, the same top rate of the richest Americans was 91%. You're playing silly games. Neither party is prepared to do it. That's why you need a new political movement. That's why Occupy is not within the Republican Party or within the Democratic Party. That's a crucial distinction between the Occupy movement, for example, and the Tea Party movement. The Tea Party movement is well located inside the Republican Party. It doesn't want to go outside. It doesn't need to. It wants to capture a Republican Party for which it believes it is already the major base. That's a crucial difference. The Occupy knows that the political system here has been derelict in its duty, both parties, by being part of, rather than a critic of, the cheerleading for a system that doesn't work, that has produced the 99 and 1%, and therefore needs a complete overhaul if it is ever again going to play the role of being a force for equality and democracy.
Well, either way, you can use it or not.
Yeah, yes. At least get it on mic.
Okay. The problem with our capitalist system is this, that when in the United States, you're successful, as American capitalism has been since the 1970s, in keeping wages basically flat, in allowing the mass of Americans only to continue consuming since the 1970s by borrowing the money to pay for these things, which it can no longer do because the level of debt being carried by the American people is not serviceable. That is, they can't carry the debt already. As any idiot could tell you, if you keep increasing the level of debt on a basically flat or stagnant wage base, there comes a time when you can't pay for it. That time is called 2007, and that's why we're in the enduring crisis we're in, because the mass of Americans cannot continue to buy the way they have, and that is hurting the American economy. Well, the answer then comes back. American corporations don't care. What they can't sell in the United States, they will go and sell someplace else. Now, that is partly true, and that is indeed happening. Every major American corporation, almost without exception, will tell you that the growth it foresees over the next 5 to 15 years is in markets overseas, that the United States is what they call, quote unquote, a mature economy. And like that word often means, it hides dead or dying or uninteresting or over the hill or so forth. That's a very bad prognosis for the United States. It means the big corporations, having wrung the profits out of America that the last 100 years permitted them, are now moving on to other pastures, leaving the United States a place where little investment will be undertaken, where the quality of the housing stock and the transportation and the public infrastructure will be allowed to deteriorate, which you can see everywhere going on anyway, that's a very bad thing. But in the long run, it doesn't work because the same problem is reproduced elsewhere in the world. One of the things holding back the rest of the world from picking up what Americans can no longer buy is that the wages paid, for example, to the workers in China and India are so abysmally low that they are growing areas, but they cannot grow and will not in the foreseeable future at a scale to compensate for the loss of what was the world's number one consuming market, the United States, which can't play that role anymore. And that's one of the reasons we have an enduring crisis. And to give you one concrete example, economists estimate that the capacity to produce automobiles in the world is 2 to 3 times what can be afforded by the people of the world to buy cars. The Chinese, the Indians are building car-producing factories, while the ones we have here are sitting in Detroit and elsewhere, dying, vacant, weeds growing in the parking lot. Capitalism has overproduced the capacity for making cars, now on a global scale, replicating what it did before on a national scale. That is a system that isn't working very well. The world doesn't need empty, unutilizable car factories that were expensive to build and should never have been built.
Or the world may not need more cars, some people would say. So then it's about reexamining those needs.
If you add that dimension, that the car itself is in question, then the overcapacity is even greater because we shouldn't be doing that. We should be producing collective transportation mechanisms, et cetera.
I mean, on that very subject, I know you go back and forth to France, you have family there, et cetera. There's the example of Germany, which is sort of not behaving the way economists would model it to be. I mean, that's the fun thing about economists is that people don't always behave the way they think they will. A little bit more about Europe, because I think sometimes in the U.S., and you speak a lot about the U.S. economy, but I think you've got something to offer us about cars or anything else when it comes to some of the European economies.
Well, the Europeans are an amazing story to tell. It's almost as though the Europeans haven't learned the lessons of their own history. And it's kind of sad and frightening to watch. Let me give you an example. After much struggle over the last century, the Europeans understood that having slaughtered one another on a scale the world had never seen before in 2 consecutive world wars, World War I and World War II, and having seen that those wars were fought by intense nationalisms in which Germans slaughtered French and the British slaughtered the Germans and so on, they decided to try to build a unity, a unified Europe, and which now has, to its credit, a common European community and, for a subset of those countries, a common currency called the euro. Those are steps towards a United States of Europe, in a sense comparable to the United States of America. They had to have understood that simply creating a unified geographic area and even creating a unified currency, they still had to deal with the differences between the different parts of Europe in terms of their politics, but even more important, in terms of their economics. What brought Europe to world war were economic conflicts. They now admit that, whether they were around colonialism and imperialism before World War I, or whether they were around the struggle against the Soviet Union, which had a lot to do with World War II, and also colonial struggles in those days. The bottom line is, you're not going to survive, you're not going to achieve your goal of avoiding slaughtering one another if you do not take the time to create the equality, roughly, and the democracy without which people do not live in peace with one another. It's a sense being learned as a lesson here in the United States, too. That's why the issue of 1% versus 99 has come to the fore. Europe has the same issue, not only between rich and poor, but even more dangerously, between developed, relatively well-off economies and those that aren't. In order to make European unity succeed, therefore, the richest countries, those in the north of Europe, France and Germany and the Low Countries, to be blunt, and those in the east and south of Europe, Spain, Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Poland on down to Romania and Bulgaria, there had to be some equilibration here. You had to do a little extra for the poor ones so that they were raised, and that might have to cost a little bit the rich ones in the interests of unity. It's a little bit like in the United States. We require more taxes to be paid by the richer states than they get back in government money, and we deliver more money to the poorer states compared to what they pay in taxes. Something that their politicians conveniently forget when they beat up on the federal government, the Mississippi politicians being the grossest example practically on the planet of this sort of behavior, Republicans all. But the Democrats did the same before. Anyway, so in Europe, you failed to do that. In the 10 years roughly since the euro became a common currency, a little more than 10 years, you've had two countries, Germany and France, do relatively well. Germany, by the way, much better than France. And a whole bunch of countries do disastrously in the south. And now you are punishing the ones who didn't get the help they needed for being poor and having borrowed money, which the rich countries lent them. And you're getting this crazy conversation in Europe in which Germans refuse to help the Greeks, telling the Greeks that they're lazy and don't work hard, whereas we German, this smells, tastes, and sounds like what we used to call fascism or Nazism. It has terrible reverberations in the south of Europe. It makes Greeks and Italians hostile to the Germans in a way where you have to scratch your head to believe what's going on there. And what does it all come from? Here's the answer. And it's the same situation in the United States. In Europe, you have allowed a capitalism to develop that polarizes rich and poor within countries and across countries. This has now gone to a point where it's intolerable, where you are undermining the living conditions of a mass of people who can sit and look down the street at the other extreme, the 1%, who are living the life of Riley, imagining that this situation is not all going to collapse around them. This is the sign of decadence. It's the sign of empires towards the end, the twilight of their existence. This is the time in Europe and the United States to which historians will look back, as they do to the last years of every empire, wondering how in the world the people couldn't see the handwriting on the wall. You cannot have rich people and poor people living together in this way, with the rich becoming richer and the poor becoming ever more desperate. The only way to keep the lid on that situation is with a level of repression that makes life unbearable in the end for everybody. And that's when these systems collapse. Then what's left to those of us who see it is to say, my God, before it all hits the fan, can't we reasonably sit down? Not just those of us at the short end of the stick, but even those who think they're living the life of Riley, and to discover it's in your interest, too, to bring this system to a peaceful conclusion and set up a different one that works better. You know, in the days of slavery, the slave masters were very rich right till the end, and the slaves were in deep trouble. But eventually, those communities, sometimes in bloody ways, sometimes not, were able to realize that system had to go. No more masters, no more slaves. Likewise, in feudalism, eventually, no more serfs, no more lords. We are at a point in our history where we have to ask at least the question, is the difference between the employer class and the employee class about done? It's not working well. There's not a rising tide. It's not lifting all the boats. Time to move on. We can thank capitalism for what it contributed, a rate of technical advance that is remarkable in human history, a whole set of progressive steps for a while. But the negatives, the costs, have caught up. America can do better than capitalism.
That's economist Rick Wolf proclaiming optimistically that it's game over. Thanks.